Hey everybody, it's a Wednesday edition of the Shay Anything Podcast. Doug Williams alongside Andy Martino, who, after being counted down by the producer,
I wasn't paying attention.
Said, God, I feel gross today.
It's a podcast.
The reason for that, well, Andy looks like he feels gross only because
Wait a minute.
You have a beard for the first time in a while. You're coming off vacation.
Growth.
You've been telling me about how gross you feel. It's all kind of culminating into...
I'm off today. I'm a little sleep deprived. It's a first world problem. I went on a lovely trip, and then we had some air delays. Mm-hmm. And I'm fine.
And you know what's a great mixture?
I just feel off. I feel bloated.
Sleep deprivation, taking it to Twitter, and then having a podcast. Which is...
I didn't tweet about sleep deprivation.
No, but you are sleep deprived and you've been active on Twitter today.
I've been working. I've been reporting.
That's true. You got a column up on SNY.TV about a team that we shall not name.
The Royals.
So you've been away, but you're reporting. You're working. The best way to kind of summarize what's happening with the Mets is...
Yeah.
A 500 team, which is exactly what they are.
Right.
They're coming off a nice win in Los Angeles. Do you think that that is where this team is going to be for a while, or is this a period of time where we're going to look back and look at them as the team that was treading water while a lot of their pieces were on the shelf?
What do you think?
Well, if you look at the guys who've had to step up, you know, Carlos Gomez has actually been a big piece for them. And I think if you had told Brody and Mickey early on in the season that Carlos Gomez is going to be a key part of your team, they would have said something has gone awry. However, I keep going back to DeGrom and Syndergaard. We talked about this on Baseball Night in New York last night. DeGrom and Syndergaard not being great, that's going to be a problem year long if it continues, and that's going to
You mean if it continues, the team will have a problem?
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
And so as much as it's easy to get distracted by the bullpen either being great or struggling, or it's easy to get distracted by Rajay Davis hitting homers and Aaron Altair somehow hitting homers and them making that work offensively. But what I'm focused on right now is the pitching. And I'm seeing good things out of Steven Matz, and I'm seeing not such good things out of DeGrom and Syndergaard.
Pretty good things out of Wheeler.
Yep. About what you expected. Maybe not quite what you expected out of Wheeler, but decent things out of Wheeler.
Yeah, well, I think Wheeler's been really good, and obviously Matz has been really good. And you summed it up. Look, this is no kind of season for the Mets if DeGrom and or Syndergaard does not consistently improve. We've talked about this before. DeGrom has a better chance than Syndergaard to improve, in our opinion. I think we share that opinion. However, he still hasn't ripped off that streak of great starts like he had last year, anything approaching last year. He had a troubling setback recently. DeGrom did. And Syndergaard's just like, dude, what's wrong with you? Head scratcher, just week in and week out. And his value has certainly dropped through the league when you talk to other executives who might be looking for pitching. Wheeler is way more appealing to other teams right now than Syndergaard is. We'll get there in a minute. But in terms of what the Mets are right now, I think it's a great point. And I can tell you, I can present some reporting that the other teams are wondering that too. Teams are looking at the Mets right now and saying, this doesn't feel like a team where it's their year, where they're going to be great. And wouldn't it be nice if certain players, like, say, Wheeler, became available at the trade deadline? Because that'll be in demand.
Right.
Other teams right now are thinking that's probably, in the baseball sense, where the Mets are more likely than not headed, although you never know. But they are also doubting that the Mets would actually pull the trigger on becoming sellers because of the way that the new GM came in and talked up the season and talked about win now and sold that not only to the owners who decided to hire him, but to the fan base. It would be tough. That would be a real reversal. I've seen stranger things.
Right.
It could happen, like that kind of reversal, but that would be a real reversal. So in terms of what kind of team they are right now, I think it's almost like, who are they really? And then what could they accept? What could they actually be? What they really are this relatively up and down mediocre team right now. We've seen it for a while, but could they actually self-identify as such in a season that began with such fanfare? That's what other teams, I'm telling you, are wondering.
Well, let's go through that all of what you just said, and let's save Brody and in a way Mickey and that big picture, that larger conversation for later. But Noah Syndergaard has so much to do with everything you're talking about, right? Because he is a big part of the reason the Mets are struggling at times and why they're not having a better season. But he's also potentially a big part of what they'll do July 31st if they end up, you know, an under 500 team and end up being sellers. So what I find so interesting about Syndergaard right now, Andy, is after each game that he struggles, he is honest about his struggling and is very transparent about the fact that mentally he's off. And I'm starting to see how many times have you and I on this podcast talked about, you know, the fan perspective on Syndergaard. They love the personality on Twitter. They love the superhero vibe. But I'm not sure how much longer of that will he has bought. And now on Twitter after games, when SNY posts the video of him being like, I don't know, pitching sucks. Like, I'm just not there. Fans are like, well, figure it out. You know, like you're supposed to be this guy. And there are those inevitable comparisons to Matt Harvey. And I guess the point of what I'm saying is Syndergaard may eventually figure it out, he may not. But I like his honesty about his struggles, and I so prefer it to Matt Harvey and what Matt Harvey used to do, which was, you know, that slider I threw right before I gave up the grand slam that was hit 500 feet was a really well-thrown pitch.
But at the end of the day, obviously it's a results business, and Syndergaard is not pitching effectively, so who really cares what he says at a certain point? Yeah. I mean, and he's an inconsistent personality, too. There are times when he'll be that way, and it'll be refreshingly sort of open. And then there's other times where he'll say something like, well, it's bullshit that they're going to fire them, talking about firing Mickey. And it's like, what are you talking about? That was off tone of, like, the feeling probably in your clubhouse and your organization. And it was like he likes to make these big statements sometimes. So sometimes you like his public persona, and sometimes he leaves you scratching his head.
Yeah, I'm not talking necessarily about his public persona.
Was I allowed to say that?
Well, you're quoting him, and we can bleep it out. We'll leave it up to the producers, but I'm not talking about his public persona. I am talking about his own critique of his pitching.
But who says that Syndergaard is effectively self-diagnosing?
No, but I would rather him...
Accurately.
I know that what he's doing is not necessarily helping. He's basically, after every start, throwing his hands up in the air. But... I think a lot of people for some reason are seeing that as weakness. I would disagree with that.
I appreciate your point. I take your point that absolutely some fans want just empty bravado over honesty or openness. And one thing I think you're saying you appreciate about Syndergaard, which I can certainly agree with, is that he is willing to say, I don't have a prepared quote for you. I don't have this packaged statement after a game. I'm sort of exploring my thoughts and my feelings about it, and I'm going to present them as I explore them. And I think that's great. I agree with you. I have no objection to that, nor should anybody. Perhaps some fans do if you're seeing tweets. Maybe those fans are, just disgruntled by the performance.
But your first reaction is exactly where the fans are, this is a results business. Just be better.
Well, that's true. But I don't have a problem with the specific kinds of comments you're talking about. I think, sure, it's great. We in the media business appreciate a guy who's willing to be themselves up there. I'm just saying that coming from Syndergaard, who's all over the place a little bit, sometimes he's got this defiant thing where, like, the press is wrong and that, like, talking about, oh, just extend the Grom when it was, like, really you're going to assert yourself into this scenario. And that one sort of worked out well for him the way it played out. But I don't know. It's just... He's clearly, it feels like he's not only searching for what kind of pitcher to be, but what kind of, like, quote to be, and that's fine.
Right.
You know, we're all searching. I'm searching for what kind of man to be, Doug.
Well, what's funny about the podcast world is that we try, and we talk about it sometimes before episodes, where we're like, all right, let's try and make this something you could listen to in 3 days, you know, for the sake of this example, when Syndergaard throws a gem his next time out, would this still be an interesting conversation? And every year in the Major League Baseball season, I think back to when I thought all hell was breaking loose and it turned out okay. And then I think back at times where I thought a certain team that got hot was going to end up winning the World Series and it didn't end up that way. And with Syndergaard, I find that I'm just on this roller coaster of when he's great, thinking that's who he is, and when he's not good, thinking that's who he is. And I don't know what
my... He's got great stuff, and he gets into a rhythm, and he's got the ability to pitch a dominant game. But I think this would be an evergreen discussion for a while because he's got to put together a long period of dominance to be the guy
right.
that people think he is or want him to be. And his inconsistency, I would remain a story. And to me, he's got to have a second half like Wheeler had last year, where you go, Noah Syndergaard's been a top pitcher for months before this discussion really changes.
Right.
And I don't think that we've seen a ton this year to suggest that that's where it's going, because it's one step forward, two steps back. And he's just not – talent is not the question. The ability to dominate on a given day is not the question. It's consistency that's the question.
And I guess that's my exact point, right? So if he throws a gem against the Dodgers, that would still make this conversation relevant because
– in my opinion.
You just – with him right now, you can't overreact to the bad or the good because the next start may be the total opposite. But at some point, you'd think that a trend is going to happen either way that is longer than two or three starts at a time.
Or not. Or he could just be a guy with a huge arm and a ton of ability who doesn't really know how to pitch, so you're going to get a mixed bag.
But at one point or 2 points in his career, he knew how to pitch.
Or he had a little bit better stuff. He had that 95-mile-an-hour slider. It had that huge depth on it.
Yeah.
He was able to come up and I mean, he had the same on his fastball, but perhaps hitters have adjusted to it as he hasn't shown the ability to change speeds and change location and do the kinds of things that a Jacob deGrom can do. So did he know how to pitch more a couple years ago, or was he just a little bit more dominant? That would
question.
Be a question for... dig deeper into a question. It'd be interesting to hear Nelson and Ron and people like that really, really dig into. But I don't remember ever talking to anybody, any evaluator or pitcher or anything, at any point where like Noah Syndergaard knows how to pitch. It's yeah. always just like Noah Syndergaard has got amazing stuff. Obviously, our listeners understand the difference. Honestly, he could throw a perfect game the next time out, and this conversation doesn't change.
Right. Well, let's give Steven Matz some credit briefly, because another good start from him last night. And Matz is a fascinating one in terms of the coverage of him. I believe we've gotten it right over the last year or so, thinking that maybe we should, maybe not think of him in the category in terms of ceiling
Certainly.
Of Wheeler, Syndergaard, and DeGrom. And think of him as a different pitcher, a guy who can still be very effective. That's exactly what he's been.
Mm-hmm.
And he has been a three-starter, a four-starter. He has been, when healthy this season, very effective other than that one bad outing. So it's possible that while, again, try and avoid distractions in the baseball season. So while we're talking about Syndergaard and DeGrom, mm-hmm. Matz is kind of
yeah.
under the radar, turning his potential career around at 28 years old.
And watching him, I was at a started in the getaway day at Citi Field last Thursday, and you just look at him and you go, you know what, this guy has good stuff. He doesn't have like otherworldly stuff, but you watch him spin that curveball and you watch him spot his fastball, and he's good, and he's probably better stuff-wise than your average three or four, but just it evens out results-wise for him into a really solid mid-rotation guy, and yeah, that's what he's become. Mets people thought over the offseason that he had learned how to pitch through pain a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And I guess we haven't completely proven that because he did go away for a while a little bit so far this year. But in terms of, like you said, when he's out there, he's good. He's solid. His ERA is under 3. Take away that start and where he didn't get any outs in Philly. You can completely write that one off because he followed it up with a number of fine outings. Steven Matz is a good pitcher. Steven Matz is not a great pitcher. No one would say he was. You're not saying he was. But it's almost like, yep, he's good. He's learned how to be a little bit more aggressive. Callaway has spoken of his confidence in Matz's start against the Dodgers. Callaway said that he's never seen that look in Matz's eye, or however he said it. And that's what they've always been looking for from Steven Matz. It's mentality more than physical ability with him that they're looking for. And he does seem to have matured into a better pitcher this year.
And Harp has a column up on SNY.TV right now.
Is it new?
It is.
Look at that.
He wrote it today.
I was
just
not
about
aware.
Almost exactly what you're saying, and mixing together the quote from Mickey Callaway after the start in mm-hmm. Los Angeles, where he said that's the best that Steven Matz has looked. He also talked to a scout and talked to Wally Backman, which is interesting, talking about the fact that the health of his elbow is the key. And big picture, though, with Mats, he came up at a time with some very different pitchers who were similar to him in age and in the same organization. And he almost became grouped together with those guys. We used to say, you know, you have this rotation of Mats and Wheeler and DeGrom and Syndergaard. But it goes to show you that if you look at especially his last year and a half about, you would, after a couple decades, look back on that and be like, oh, that's a very solid major league pitcher.
He's solid.
It's just the surroundings that kind of confuse him with the other guys.
Well, he had a long, long life as a prospect. I mean, he was obviously in the organization before any of those guys. First round pick in 2009, the Tommy John, the tough recovery from Tommy John. So he preceded even Matt Harvey as a name in the organization, and then had a long, hard road to finally make his debut in 15. And I don't know, do you really think he's at the hype of those other guys? Or has people ever really thought he was that good?
No, I don't think anyone, especially since
he came up. You're saying his name gets tossed in.
Yes.
Fair enough. And
he's in a small group of guys that is five at a time. So obviously all of them are tossed into each other at a certain extent.
Hey, look, as long as you've got Syndergaard and DeGrom at the top, it goes back to that again, and Wheeler, then Steven Matz is a phenomenal number four, obviously. He can't be that much more important to you because you could never count on how healthy he's going to stay. And he's still that guy that can get a little spooked and, oh, my God, I'm not getting an out. And next thing you know, like, it's snowballed. He's a lot less that guy, I think, than he used to be. He's not like Syndergaard where you're like, dude, where's your head at? He's always seemed like a good guy, a focused guy.
Almost too focused.
Yeah, like a lot of pressure on himself. Not that they all don't put pressure on themselves, but Matz, you get the sense that you always got the feeling that he got really stressed out if things weren't going well, and he really wanted to fix it, and he almost wanted it too much. And perhaps he is maturing past that, and that would be great for the Mets because they got a few years left with him, and you know if he could stay healthy, he's going to give them some quality.
I've always wanted to give him a stress ball to squeeze on the mound because just sometimes he just seems so uptight on the mound. But you
can see it.
He looked better last night, and I was just actually thinking of a book idea for you that would have Met fan appeal, but if you did it well, which I think you would.
Of course I would.
The national appeal would be there, which would be after, hopefully you're not retired by this point, but after DeGrom.
That word always reminds me of Borat.
DeGrom, Syndergaard, Mats, Wheeler, and Harvey are all out of the game.
That's not a bad
book,
idea.
A book about how they all started together and how they all went in different directions. Because I could see all of their careers going somewhere different.
Doug, that's a good book idea.
Thank you.
It really is. A little story about Steven Matz. The other day, the other week, he goes on the injured list with his elbow. And I happened to be standing in the Mets clubhouse talking to Harold Kaufman, their head communications guy. And Matz just comes over. He's like, Harold, do you need me to talk? Harold's like, Mickey's going to go in there. He's like, no, I'll do it now. It's okay, I'll do it now. And then he turns to me, he's like, I'm sorry to interrupt your conversation. It's like, nice guy.
Yeah, how about that?
Nice guy. They're not all like that. I thought the fans might enjoy that little window.
I like that window, and that's part of the book.
Pleasant right young there. Man. That's the
page,
introduction, and people
page
will be like.
A half of the introduction.
People will be like, I'm not buying this. That's not a sexy enough story.
The first thing I would do if you wrote that book
were my introduction.
Would
yes.
be to, can I just be honest about this? Check the index for W and see if you found a way to get me in.
You'd be
book.
In the acknowledgments.
What about like in the actual meat of the book?
I'm not sure your story really enters. There was that one time you saw Harvey watching a football game in the village. Maybe
that's true.
Maybe you'll be a source for that scene,
and
that's how you'll appear.
In New York, so
that, other than that, really I'm not really sure. Maybe just some.
Just like in the middle of a sentence, like
Jacob
DeGrom. Grew up in Lakeland, Florida, Doug Williams, at a small high school.
I could do that. Or I could be a little more smooth about it, like Jacob DeGrom took the mound in game 5 of the 2015 NLCS, and he had nothing. Long dash. That's a set off a separate clause. SNY's Doug Williams was in the studio. Dash. And DeGrom, blah, 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 blah. I could work you in that way, because you were peripherally involved in some of this.
I'm really not involved in any of their lives or careers, but I think it would, you know, just as a friendship thing, be nice to involve me in the book.
You'll be in the acknowledgments.
Maybe a chapter. In your first comments in the podcast, you talked a little bit about Brody, Mickey, and I think it's important for us to check back on the foreseeable future thing because we've talked about that on the podcast. And it is nice to know, if you're a Met fan out there, what you're watching in terms of Mickey's job safety. Like, mm-hmm. if they get swept in a 3 or 4 game series against a lesser team from now till the end of the season, what is the strength of his leash? Not necessarily how long right. it is, but how quickly could it end?
Not that quickly. The Mets, as I think we talked about in our extra podcast last week, the Mets had a decision to make last Monday: fire the guy or announce that he's safe for a while. They couldn't live in that middle ground anymore, so they're not in that middle ground anymore. It would have to get pretty bad again. They decided they're going to keep him for a good while, whether that's a couple of weeks, a couple of months. I think that does depend how it plays out. So I guess if I'm talking a couple of weeks, then maybe that would be quick. But there's, in the aftermath of that, there are Mets people really trying to talk up the fact that it's very, very, very likely that Mickey's here the rest of the year. And then other people will tell you privately in a way that's not as designed to be, you know, something I say on the air. Like, obviously he's not the guy. He's not a guy. Right. It's just a matter of when. But when could be that matter of when could be a while. It's risky. You could end up winning and getting stuck with a guy who's not your guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you could, like, what if this works out for the Mets?
That's what I want to get.
That happened to them with Terry. I love Terry. But there were a couple times when Alderson wanted to get rid of him, and then the Mets, like, made the playoffs, and he's like, damn it.
Right. When a front office wants to move on, sometimes for the right reasons and for good reason, and then it ends up in a way, the baseball doesn't add up to. But that's where I want to go with you, because you tweeted, and rightly so, after that win that Rajay Davis hit the home run, I think that was the game, you were like, you know, it's funny, if Mickey Callaway had been fired, mm-hmm. This win would have led to some stupid storyline where it was like,
right, the
Mets
Riggleman
were jolted.
Renaissance.
Yeah, the Riggleman renaissance, he takes the job, suddenly the team turns the season around. I know a lot of your baseball opinions are informed by conversations you have with baseball people.
Right.
Do you think that baseball people believe that changing managers in season, keeping your manager or firing your manager, like, the results of that don't end up actually mattering on the field?
Not much. That's it. I would say baseball people consider that an annoying media narrative that they have to deal with for the most part. And in New York, it really does develop its own life of like, well, the manager may or may not be the problem with the team, but if you're losing, let's start talking about the manager. I've seen it develop numerous times, as you have. You just start like, hey, is the manager, some reporter, is the manager safe? Fair question. But then there's an answer. Then it's the manager safe. But for how long? And then it just becomes this whole thing, like, to the point where the Mets actually had to address it last week. Not that they weren't thinking about it themselves, but, you know, it does take on a life of its own in the media. And I think baseball people find that annoying. I think they think that, there's obviously a variance of opinion. But if I could sum it up, my understanding would be that in many cases, a managerial change is viewed as trying to put a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound, or whatever the term is. But there are some cases where a team needs a culture change or a jolt or a breath of fresh air. Boy, that was a lot of cliches. One of those cliches needs to be applied to a clubhouse, and why not? Hey, this season might be getting away from us. We like our talent level. Let's see if a new guy can't come in and change the feel. These are human beings who can respond differently to different bosses. In our workplaces, certain types of bosses can make us more or less productive in the short term because of how we respond to their leadership style. It's not nothing. It's just that the talent level and the team is much more important. That's all.
But your point about kind of the times where a front office thinks, okay, this isn't our guy and we want to get rid of this manager, but the team starts winning and they're unable to. What's funny is when eventually managers who, technically speaking, surface level to the fans, are not failing at their job get fired. Thinking of two examples, Dusty Baker and Joe Girardi. Dusty Baker with the Nationals lost his job kind of out of nowhere, and the Nationals have, and rightly so, gotten criticized ever since. Mm-hmm. Joe Girardi, his team was successful, but we've since found out a lot of the issues and the cracks in the armor there that led to his demise.
That was a firing on merit, for sure.
But so, the public is hard on those moves. Like, we view that as like, that seemed weird. He didn't deserve the firing. But there's always more digging to do. Mm. So, like, if the Mets have a decent season and move on from Mickey Callaway after the year, that's a story to tell. It's not just like a guy losing his job without merit.
Sure. No, if they fire him, it'll be because they want a new manager and they have the reasons that they think that he's not their guy. And I don't think they think he's their guy. So it's just a matter of, you know, he's got a year and a half, a little bit more left on his contract. How much of that does he get to serve? Maybe they go on a crazy winning streak and end up in the NLCS this year and he comes back next year. That's the in a weird backwards way, that's kind of the risk you run by keeping him.
And also in his case,
you'll take it if you win.
You might, if you're winning, you would never fire him because you don't want to break that up.
Well, even sometimes like the ones you mentioned, Baker and Girardi, one rightly so and one probably not rightly so. The Nationals ownership overreacted to a series loss. And the Yankees knew what they were doing in that case. But, like, in both cases, like, they had success. They went to the postseason. They still were like, this is not our guy going forward. I think that happens a little more than it used to.
Right. It's a tricky thing to win over the public with that decision.
You win, right, sure. I don't think Mickey Callaway.
It might be the right decision.
Has anyone in the Mets fan base, like, developed an emotional attachment to Mickey Callaway?
No, but if the Mets have a very good rest of the season, make the playoffs, don't win the World Series or get to the World Series, and the Mets move on this offseason, I think Brody will be viewed harshly for that decision. Because even though the Mets front office may believe they can do better at manager, Mets fans just watched a successful season.
Yeah, yeah, well.
And I know I'm talking about a
managers that they don't love. Yeah.
A lot would have to happen for this to ever come true.
We were talking about first world problems before this podcast began. And
right,
that
this
would be one,
I
guess.
Mets fans, I think, may take this problem.
And the Mets would take it. Like, well, we don't love our manager, but we just won. Okay, you can stay. Now we can just have you. Believe me, they'll sort it out if they win. And that's how Mets people were talking in the wake of not firing Callaway last week. It was like, obviously, someone like me is trying to figure out how long does he have, and the answer I was getting was, well, that's not a fair question because our plan is to win.
Right.
You know, we're going to win. That's what, and if we do what we set out to do, then this is not a conversation anymore. And that's what they were trying to put a hold on. And they have put a hold on it. He's safe for a while.
The two games in the Dodgers series, and I know you've been away, have been kind of a perfect microcosm of the confusion. And they looked, again, in game one of the series, it looked like great team versus a team that was dead in the water. And then game two, Michael Conforto hits a grand slam, Steven Matz six solid innings. You're like, yeah, you know what? This team can compete against one of the best teams in baseball.
Yeah.
So it's just right now we're kind of in flux. Like, I don't know if we know what the team's like because I don't think the team that is on the field right now resembles at all what the team will look like for the rest of the year.
You never know in baseball. You really don't. Well, nothing's ever settled until the season's over, right? Like the year the Mets made the World Series, they were awful for many, many days of that season. And it's hard to, obviously in baseball, you can't know anything about a team's identity in a given. It's too bad because it would be fun to say, hey, let's see how they match up against the Dodgers this week. Hey, let's see how the Yankees match up against the Rays in this. But it just doesn't, it doesn't mean anything other than a win or loss. You don't learn. In basketball, you learn. Okay, let's see how these two teams look against each other. And the better team in basketball, say you take a seven-game, best-of-seven postgame series, or postseason series, the better team wins, right? Baseball is just random. You don't learn anything, but you enjoy it.
Yeah, the chances increase in a seven-game series of the better team winning the series as compared to a three-game series. And sometimes the better team doesn't win. And it's just like the team is slumping and suddenly something odd happens.
It tells you nothing. In September, if the Yankees and Rays play a crucial series in September, that won't how they looked against each other in May obviously won't inform that at all.
And by the way, your 2015 point is a good one. And that was something that Syndergaard, when he used the expletive that you used earlier, did say. Like he was like, things were worse back then. You know, things were really bad. And imagine knowing how it ended up if Terry had been fired when Mayberry and Eric Campbell were in the lineup. And how unfair that seems now from our perspective. Not that dissimilar from what we were looking at, with the exception of, you know, your actual knowledge about the difference between those two guys as managers.
Yeah, well, I was going to say Terry was a pretty good manager.
Right. I'm just saying, I actually thought it was a good point from Syndergaard to remind the fan base that things can go from as bad as they possibly can seem, rock bottom, to much better because it's such a long season.
That's true. My only thing I was saying about that was this idea that you're speaking, or this sort of implication that you're speaking for the group on something.
No, yeah.
I'm not so sure that that's earned.
True. What did you do on Saturday night?
I had a lovely Saturday night. Vaguely what I did. I was in Miami Beach celebrating my wife's birthday. Just a little mini vacation over the holiday weekends on some points and miles. And we went to this great restaurant. That was awesome.
I love combining points and miles into a trip that at the end you feel like, all right.
We didn't spend that much money.
Incredibly poor after that.
No, we weren't. We did spend, our one expenditure was Saturday night. It was this restaurant called Los Fuegos, which is an Argentinian steakhouse. So, you know, Miami, you just feel so cool everywhere you are. Like, you put on your coolest outfit, your hippest outfit, and you go. It was in this hotel down on Miami Beach where there was like a Damien Hirst actual sculpture in a big box and like overlooking the beach, and you could see the beach through this clear box that the sculpture was in, the palm trees. And then you go into the place, and the design of the restaurant was incredible, and the food was incredible. And then there's like this hip kind of band that played after, and just that Miami crowd. Miami's one of the better people watching cities in the world to me. You just got so many weirdos.
I have not spent nearly enough time.
And I mean that as a compliment. Yeah. Awesome city. There's not that many places where you can go have a beach day. Like Corona with your lunch at 11:45 a.m. and then, you know, clean up, shower, and like go to an awesome city. Like on the other side of your hotel. You know, it's like beach one side, cool city the other side. I love that. There are a few cities that way. Miami's one of them.
I had dinner at Bostwick's in East Hampton, which is a nice little...
Look at us!
Yeah.
What is this what are we just lording it over the masses? These
I did drive
people
back.
We don't always live like this.
I drove back to the city after it, but it was lovely. It was.
Were you with Alec, Lorne, and Sir Paul?
Why that group of people? Were they?
That's when I think Hamptons. That's come on. That's like Hamptons.
The only reason
royalty.
I'm reacting is because yes, that's exactly the group.
I nailed it, yeah. and I shouldn't. That
was almost creepy.
I stepped out of line.
All right, everybody, I promise we're not always this bougie if this is your first episode.
I haven't taken a trip with my wife in like 3 years.
Yeah, you earn it with miles and points.
Exactly.
Thanks for listening, everybody, to the Shay Anything podcast. We'd love to have you again. If you wouldn't mind subscribing, rating, and reviewing us, we always appreciate it. Have a good week. We'll talk to you on Monday of next week.
That's true.